My name is Kira Kasner. I am 16 years old. Today is June 4th, 2018, and I am speaking with Ellie Coburn, who is a family friend. We are recording this interview over the phone in San Diego, California.
Yes, I'm Ellie Coburn. I'm 22 years old, and I am here tonight with Kira, sitting in my home in Little Italy, ready to chat.
Okay, so the first question that I have for you is, can you tell me about one or two people who have been the biggest influences on your life?
So primary influence for me that kind of started everything was my father. And do I tell a little bit about him?
Yeah.
Okay. So he was an incredible person that I had in my life until I was 13. And he kind of set the stage for my standard of living and how to be a good person. And when he passed away, suddenly when I was 13, I had this mentality that I was going to go into the world and live life to the fullest and kind of do and be everything that I know that he would have wanted for me. And then kind of a current person that I really look up to, her name is Glennon Doyle, and she is a popular blogger slash activist who started her campaign as just like a mommy blogger and was just doing like very benign work within like the mom community. And she ended up using her platform to just radically reform major, major things to do with. She basically was like this, you know, quaint, quiet, potentially conservative woman who came out of the woodwork as this individual who is doing like fierce advocacy work for like the marginalized kids that are refugees. And she's actually now with Abby Womack, which is a woman soccer player for the Olympics. And she's just this incredible person. And she, all of her advocacy work that she does, like within the refugee community, she's definitely someone that I aspire to be more like because she's so active in like the political realm.
Very interesting. So I'm gonna so you talked about your dad a little bit. So can you talk to me a little bit about the experience that you had growing up, and then obviously the big change when suddenly your dad wasn't there anymore?
Yeah, I think that my foundation was really, really strong. I think that, you know, just being in a setting where I felt so loved and so supported and so empowered to be anybody that I wanted to be, and that was so heavily instilled into me that, you know, I could be anything. Like, if I wanted to be a dancer, I could be a dancer. If I wanted to be a singer, I could be a singer. And if I wanted to be the president, I could be the president. And I feel like because my parents, you know, they instilled those values, not just with words, but with action, that I still hold those things to be true today, which is why I've never felt confined to any box. I've never felt like I had to do a certain thing to prove, you know, that I was following the standards of society. And so that was, like, a really strong piece of my upbringing. But there was also a lot of joy in my childhood. We knew how to have fun, our family. We worked hard and we played hard. And I think that definitely set the stage for me to be able to have such fond memories to kind of, like, build my life on. You know, that foundation was just so good. And, you know, when my dad died, it was a tragedy, but it was a tragedy because life was so good. And I kind of now, almost 9 years later, look at it as, like, what an incredible opportunity to know someone so worth missing and to be raised and loved by someone so worth missing. And so for me now, I mean, there's not a day that goes by, you know, feel emotional about it, but I definitely feel like I've gotten to a place where I can realize that there is, like, a silver lining in the loss, because you wouldn't miss someone 9 years later if they weren't truly extraordinary, you know? And that's kind of the way that I look at it.
Definitely. Occasionally, someone will bring up, like, a parent dying or something in class, And one of my first thoughts is actually of your dad, because I also remember the day he died extremely clearly for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know him as well as you did, but he was still, he was an incredible person, and I still think about him.
Well, he was a key part of your childhood, too, I feel like, and so I can understand, like, of course you remember the day that he died, because he was kind of, like, a key influence. I mean, your dad, I remember your dad being there for me the day that he died, and so it's kind of likewise, you know?
Yeah. I just, it's come up a couple times, and I just kind of, oh, he was such a wonderful person.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He was the life of the party, for sure. And it's definitely good to have that preservation of him because, I mean, I know that there were areas that he fell short, but the magical thing about death is that it feels like only the good pieces of you live on, you know?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Where should I go next? Because I have so many things that I want to talk to you about. So I think one of the things that I want to talk to you about is the Lucy Project.
Yes, my project that is currently on hold, but will definitely come back. Lucy Project, do you want me to just start? Or specific question?
I just want you to talk about it. I don't have any specific questions about it.
Okay. Well, it's kind of going to wrap around to something that may be another question of yours because I have to kind of talk about the backstory a little bit. But essentially, what a lot of people don't know and what you might be interested to find out because it's not anybody's public knowledge is that the reason why I started to do work in other countries was actually, and the reason why I started my photography business and everything else was actually born out of immense depression and anxiety in my high school experience. I had, like we had talked about, lost my dad in the eighth grade and then transitioned over to high school literally months later. And it wasn't until about a year or so later that the reality and the grief caught up with me and that I had to essentially go to high school, live a normal life, and cope with the, like, you know, the terms of, oh my gosh, my dad's really gone and he's not coming back. And that combined with like the stress of popularity and fitting in and grades and everything else, I met my match and I completely broke down to the point where there were several months that I could not function and I had to get, you know, mental, emotional support and help. And essentially, by the time that my senior year rolled around, very early in my senior year, I knew that I had to make a decision between either going my own way and forging my own path and choosing to get better or literally dying by trying to go with the flow of my senior year of high school. And so I left high school, and I literally on my the morning after my 18th birthday packed up a stuff in a laundry basket and drove up to San Francisco where I had like a family friend staying and I didn't even tell my mom. She went crazy. But I was like, this is what I have to do. And literally that night my mom said, okay, you know what? I get this is what you have to do. And she actually embraced it. So I left school. I was a high school dropout. I had nothing going for me, but I felt like I needed to like buy a camera, which is so weird because why would anyone buy a camera when they have literally that amount of money to their name and they've just dropped out of high school and they have no experience with cameras? But I felt the need to do it, and I just felt led. I definitely do believe in Jesus and God, and I find myself thinking that, you know, I felt pulled into that. And so I bought a camera, and I literally, 4 weeks later, was making revenue off of a photography company, and 6 months later, I was getting awards as a family photographer. And so it really transitioned very quickly. It was an amazing experience, and thankfully it worked because it was literally sink or swim time, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was to the point where you either bought the camera and failed miserably and literally had no money to your name, or you bought the camera, were super creative in the way that you got your clientele and your client base, and made a career, which is what I desperately needed at that time. I ended up getting my GED, having this career beneath me, having enough money to basically go and do whatever I wanted to do, but still having that sadness of, you know, my anxiety and depression. And for whatever reason, I decided, you know, what better way to kind of go forth and do something crazy that might stark change in, like, my emotions at the time than to go abroad. And so that kind of started the whole thing. And so I got in contact with an individual who did a lot of media work for an orphanage in Zimbabwe. And I collaborated with that individual. I went over to Zimbabwe on what was supposed to be a 10-day trip. And I had all this planned out that I was going to go in. We had all these particular pictures I was going to take for the orphanage. I was going to get free lodging and get to experience Zimbabwe for these 10 days. And when I went, I basically fell in love with it. I fell so in love with it. And I actually ended up on one of the 10 days going to this other orphanage that was significantly farther out in what we call the bush, which is like the middle of nowhere. So you have this orphanage that's like on display, like thousands and thousands of dollars are going into it. They have a media campaign, and that's the orphanage I was originally working for. These kids are well-nourished, well-liked. They have, you know, clothes to wear. They have a school to go to that's private. You know, yes, they are orphans, and that's super sad, but they didn't have, you know, a devastating life by any means. They had house mothers at the orphanage that cared for them. They had all of these things. And that was what, like, my perception at the time of, like, okay, this is not that bad. This is what orphanages in Africa look like. But then on that one day that the woman invited me to go see a different orphanage further out in the bush, my perspective of the world radically changed. Because there's an orphanage that sits at the base of a mountain. It's this incredible, incredible, like, geographically, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. But there is more poverty there than I can ever explain, like, until someone actually goes there and sees it for themselves. Because there's this orphanage that's not funded, has no media campaign, has nobody coming out to it. There's literally 80 children and 2 adults. And it's like Lord of the Flies. It's like one of the worst possible seasons you can possibly imagine. And yet the kids are so resilient and they're so joyful. And I fell in love with them, and I didn't leave for 2.5 months. And I ended up taking the position as a house mother there and basically just working with the kids and loving on them and being a part of their day-to-day life. And I totally just, like I said, fell head over heels in love with this community that was literally in the definition of crisis. And what I had learned when I was there is how normal that these children are, and how despite all of these things stacked against them, I mean, literally there were peers at the orphanage who were dying from being impoverished, and there was nothing that I could do. What I learned is that the one thing that these kids wanted more than anything is to have their story be told. And they talked about it a lot. I used to do nightly classes with them where I would teach them English and English, you know, skill sets, because they spoke a very specific African dialect that essentially is only spoken in their tribe. And so it leaves them no opportunity for growth. And so I would teach them English in an effort to try to globalize them a bit. And during that time, there was one individual that spoke strong English. So that was the one who would interpret for me. And you know, I would ask the kids at the end of the night, like, as we would recap at the end of the class, I would say, like, you know, I just ask them their opinions on things. They'd ask me about America. You know, I'd ask them about different this and that. And then it was always, 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 like, are you going to tell, you know, your friends about us? Like, and one girl had told me something so profound. She had said, like, I just want people to know that I'm just like them. And it is so important to me, and it became kind of like my life mission to educate people on like these essentially forgotten people. It feels like no one really knows that they exist, and even if they did know that they existed, they might see themselves as so superior to them that they would never even want to create that relationship with them or attempt to like see them as an equal or give them an opportunity to be successful in the world. And that's kind of what sparked the idea behind the Lucy Project, because I wanted to give a voice and, you know, a face to every single individual that's living in these situations and these circumstances that aren't seen and don't feel heard. And the best way that I've learned how to do that is through storytelling. And there is another individual documentary kind of movement that is very similar to the Lucy Project called the Archibald Project. And I didn't actually know about the Archibald Project's existence when I started the Lucy Project. And I would say that I also look up to them as, like, another contributor to, like, who, you know, you asked me earlier on, like, who I look up to. And I appreciate the work that they're doing so much. And I don't think that I'll devote my life to the degree that the Archibald Project owners have because I have so many other life goals. But I do really, really desire to go back into the field and complete the series, which is going to every single continent with the exception of Antarctica, obviously, because there's not really orphans in Antarctica. And, you know, and basically taking pictures there to show what the crisis looks like. And then also, you know, going through and introducing people so that they don't become, they're not just faces. Because in the early 2000s and like even in the 90s, like Time Magazine and National Geographic and everything, they would go to these places and they would take these pictures of these nameless orphans. And then they would just, like, basically portray them as these helpless people with no stories. And so what I want to do is I want to say their name, and I want to be able to – that's why it's called the Lucy Project, because it's named after an individual that I met, and it was, like, such a divine encounter that I met Lucy. But essentially, I just want to stop the whole, like, oh, here's a picture of this black child that has no, you know, money, no hope, no future, and be like, hey, this is – so-and-so, and this is her story, and this is what she wants to be when she grows up. And more about them and less about the whole, I don't know, idea of poverty and being able to come and save these people. Because if you're there long enough and you're with them enough and you treat them as equals, you'll find that you're actually going to be more likely to be saved by them than you are to save them.
That's a very good point, actually. Am I correct to make the assumption that it was put on hold because of your foster child?
Yes, it was. So I actually had a dream, literally night. I was literally planning on. It's interesting because during the Lucy Project, I had the opportunity to go to several different places. I was able to go to Kenya, Uganda, Zimbabwe, and I even spent a little bit of time in India. But for whatever reason, as I was planning to actually move to Africa, and I had arrangements being made, and I was looking at houses online and everything like that, I had a dream in the middle of the night that, I had this whole thing. I actually had contacts in Sweden and New York City that had venues for me to showcase the documentary, and I was in collaboration with Rio de Janeiro and just several different orphanages around the world, but I had plans to go, you know, to take the pictures, and then I had all these venues lined up to showcase the documentary. And this dream, it was a life-changing experience, and I know that some people think that it's kooky, but, like, I legitimately woke up, and I felt like my entire life had to be put on hold, and that there was nothing more important than what I needed to do. I had no intention of being a foster parent. I had no intention of doing domestic adoption. I am literally, like, the definition of the spokesperson for international works. And so I had never even looked into or thought about domestic adoption or domestic foster care because I was so hyper-focused on, you know, international adoption, international orphan crisis, crises, et cetera, et cetera. And so I woke up from this dream, and the dream was of a social worker bringing a child to my doorstep that it was clear to me that this was all transpiring in San Diego and, like, not in the middle of Africa or what have you, you know. And I could not get this little baby out of my mind, and I could not shake the idea that the dream legitimately a divine encounter to stop and do everything. And at the time when I had this dream, I was 20 years old. I had no idea where to begin, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I was actually convinced that there would be no way for this to be a reality because it seemed as though, like, wait, you know, I'm 20 years old. I can't adopt a child from America. Aren't there laws? Aren't there standards? You know, like, what does it look like? And I found out that the foster system actually allows people, like, that have the means as early as 18. And the reason that is because in America, there are a lot of siblings that will take on their younger siblings. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, typically speaking, I would say that I'm probably one of the only 22-year-olds that foster in America. but the law is 18 for the sake of people who may end up, you know, it's called kinship care, where you care for your family members at a very young age. And so I kind of snuck in with that crowd to do this work, but essentially, you know, they screen you the same way they would any other foster parent, and they can't discriminate based on age as long as you have the, like, financial means to care for the child, which I was able to do through my two businesses. And so I literally was, like, inquiring about the idea of doing this because of this dream, and everything seemed to have fallen perfectly into place. I got into the last orientation that they were offering before they did, like, an orientation hiatus, and I went through the program to become a foster parent in 13 months. And on the 13th month, I'm not even kidding, I found out that they didn't tell me this, it was not even disclosed. I found out that the average wait time for a young baby, to adopt a young baby, is between 2 and 5 years in San Diego County. So I was absolutely crushed. I thought, like, this dream was a hoax. There is no young baby out there for me. It's not even, like, I took off the Lucy Project, and I had gone through this whole process, and so I legitimately was about to throw in the towel, and I was like, you know what, no, there must be a reason why I did this. Maybe I'll just foster older kids and then one day get a baby, you know? I was just at such a loss about, like, how to cope with the fact that this dream seems to be, like, going up in smoke, and that, you know, I was worried that I had made the wrong choice or foolishly, like, put the Lucy Project on hold. And so I made the decision to switch my age range from 0 to 2 to 0 to, I think at the time it was 0 to 5. And I went in and I signed the papers, and I also made the decision to change from foster care, from adoption only, because that was what I wanted, to adopt a child, to foster, you know, I was willing and able to foster children temporarily. And that was a huge shift for me. And the worker essentially said, you know, if you sign this paper, you're going to get a call tomorrow, because there's such a great need for children in San Diego to be fostered temporarily, you know? And so, sure enough, I hadn't even walked out of her office when she gave me a call. She was calling because apparently it was like this whole weird divine thing where, for whatever reason, there was a baby available, and that she wanted me to have the baby. And it was so surreal. Now, this baby, mind you, was a foster baby that was expected to return to its mother, you know, within a few months. But it, as it transpired, the baby became available for adoption. When I met the baby, I knew immediately it was the baby from the dream. And it's just been such a beautiful, crazy journey. I named him Oliver Phoenix, which means the olive tree, born from the ashes. And olive trees represent beauty and miracles and all of this stuff. And so he's my little miracle boy, and I'm in the process of adopting him. And then we will immediately go back to work abroad, you know, continuing the Lucy Project, traveling through Europe and Southeast Asia and Africa together, kind of just being nomadic together.
That sounds awesome. It's so cool that it all just fell into place for you.
Yes, it's a very crazy story for sure, but I definitely feel like he was always meant to be mine, and I'm hopeful that the adoption goes smoothly, because, you know, I've been in this long enough now to know that foster care is messy, but I believe that all the hearts are in the right place here, even with his biological parents, and that's what makes me hopeful for his future.
Yeah, so that's, I'm trying to think of what do I want to ask next. You mentioned a second business, photography's, your photography is one, but is there, what's the second one that you're doing?
The photography is my, photography and then Young Living, essential oils. Those are my two main businesses. Health and wellness is extremely important to me, and it actually was my interest in alternative medicine came out of my inability to get better with depression medication that was prescribed from a psychiatrist. And so I kind of just fell into alternative medicine with, you know, essential oils and plant-based products and plant-based living because I was desperate for an alternative. And I fell into this amazing company, Young Living, and it was funny because for 5 years I knew that there was a business component of Young Living, but I refused to even, like, acknowledge it. But I used the products, like, so much for 5 years. I mean, my entire house was Young Living. I didn't have a single product in my home that wasn't. And then finally, it's actually interesting because I was in Zimbabwe, And it was for a second time to see the kids at Christmas last year. And I was really short on donations. I had promised these children, I mean, just the moon and the stars, because I wanted to make their Christmas so special. And I really believed that I could, you know, I could fundraise at least $5,000. And it was Christmas Eve Eve, and I had only raised, I mean, 20% of what I needed to raise. And during the 5 years that I had used the oils, I had connected with other women on Facebook and social media who also did, who did it as a business, even though I didn't. And so I guess they were seeing my posts and everything, you know. And when they saw it, they decided to band together and donate over $4,000 within 24 hours. And I had really bad connection at the time. And so I, like, looked and saw that I was getting all this money, but I didn't know from who. And then I came to find out that it was from the individuals who had actually, like, sold me the oils and who, like, were in the business. And I think what sparked my interest was, more than anything, which is, like, I was thinking to myself, like, you know, as a consumer of the product, I was just like, how are these people able to just drop $4,000 at Christmas time when they have their own families, you know? And so for me, that was where the interest began. And that's when I reached out to them and asked, like, you know, is there actually a legitimate business behind this that you can make money? Because for me, like, my biggest priority, yes, I love health and wellness. Yes, I love photography, but that's not my biggest priority. My biggest priority is being able to travel with my son and see the world and embrace culture and be immersed in different cultures that have orphan crisis, you know, crises around, so that my son actually knows and sees the world for what it is and isn't just in a bubble. And so whatever can, like, facilitate that, whether that be photography or this alternative business, was my highest priority. And it just so happened to be that I fell into it. And it's something that I can do from anywhere in the world. And it's a product that I obviously truly believe in, because I use it every day all over my house. But so, yeah, that's my second business.
Very interesting. I had seen, like, posts about it, but I hadn't, like, really looked into it at all. But it's very interesting, and it's cool how much it's helped you, because different things work for different people. And if you find something that works for yourself, obviously take advantage of it and try to get everything out of it that you can. And that's so cool. That I had heard about the whole trying to, I remember, like, my mom or someone telling me about the whole trying to get the things at Christmas time, but I hadn't realized it was with Young Living that it all came together. And
yeah, and it's a great fight. Like, we are, like, one of the few companies set up the way it is that we don't push the business on anyone. Like, I really don't. I try to avoid it at all costs, because we have people, you know, like me. I candidly approach the people above me. They never asked me once to go, you know, and be a part of it. And I said, like, hey, this business opportunity seems like it would be good for me. And that's when I learned more about it. But I will say that for my family and my circumstances, it has been a blessing to share the product. And it's nice because it's easy to sell, because it's not just essential oils, which I feel like are really foreign to people. A lot of people are like, wait, what's an essential oil? What does it do? It's also an entire line of plant-based cleaning and household products. So it's like clean makeup and, you know, cleaner, like household cleaner and dish soap and hand soap and toothpaste and all of that. And so it's definitely easier to sell that product than it is the essential oils, because people normally have to warm up to that. But people are very, like, into right now in this day and age, like, clean makeup and, you know, alternative baby products that don't have a bunch of crap and crappy chemicals in them, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's been nice. And then, like I said, it's been a way for me to keep the roof over our head and, you know, keep my kids healthy, and that's nice. So that's my other one. But photography has also, like, been a key cornerstone piece financially for me, because I think a lot of people, you know, they see my story, but they have to remember that I'm 22 and I have to keep the lights on somehow, you
yeah.
know? So I do what I can, like, in every arena to be able to afford having three kids, and well, now two, but
yeah, I saw that, and my heart kind of broke when I read your post about having to, I mean, obviously foster parenting is very tough, because you never know when things like that are going to happen, and it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Is one of the only ways to put
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and it's crazy because the reality is that I have raised my son since he was a newborn. I'm planning his first birthday. He knows no other life. I am his mama. He calls me mama. He cannot be away from me for more than, like, a couple of hours without totally breaking down. And the state has just as much power to pull him out of my home at any moment, just like they did with her. And that's what's crazy. Like, they're not going to at this point, but it's just crazy to me that the power is there, you know?
Yeah. And I've heard stories of terrible foster parents, and I absolutely applaud you for the wonderful work that you've been doing, and you've been an inspiration to me. It probably doesn't show very well, but I think about how much you've accomplished already, and you're only 22, and it wows me, because your circumstances ended up not being that great, suffering with, like, anxiety and depression, but you made the most of it, and it's been really, really inspiring for me.
Well, I appreciate that more than you know. I mean, it's definitely, there's a lot of back end stuff that I feel like is so imperfect. It's hard to believe that the final product that maybe, you know, I put into the world, or that our parents talk about, or whatever, like, is actually good, because, you know, as people, we always focus on where we're failing, and we always focus on where we can improve, and we never, you know, show that piece of the puzzle to the world, or, you know, to our social media. But I try to be as candid as possible in, you know, that way. That's kind of been, like, my trademark over the years with social media. That's kind of a promise to myself, is that, and I'm even trying it more now than I did maybe a few years ago as I get more comfortable with myself, is to just be, you know, inherently candid about the situation and the circumstances of where I'm failing and could improve. But overall, like, I think that my perspective on the world, like I said, it does come through the lens of a very liberal Christian. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but I'm also a lesbian. And so I'm not, like, by any means coming at you from a place of, like, oh, I love Christ. And, like, I do love Christ. I think he's awesome. But, like, it's not by any means, like, at the standard of, like, coming from a super conservative place. I just think that, you know, from my perspective and from my, like, lens of the world is suffering immeasurably right now. And you don't have to be perfect to show up and, you know, put out your hands and say, what can I do? And that's where I come from. It's like, I can be a mess, but I'm still going to show up and I'm still going to try. And I feel like that is, even if you are not a Christian, you can relate to that in the sense that, like, that's the good work that you should be doing as a person.
Yeah, I totally agree. I wasn't raised in a religious household, so I haven't had that experience, but it's still the knowing that I have the means to give, and that that there's so many things wrong with the world that that you need, somebody needs to do something, and if nobody else is going to do it, it's got to be me.
Exactly. And I think that we live in a pivotal season of life where people your age are entering into an opportunity to either spend the years where they are young and able, you know, partying in college, or making a, you know, valiant effort to make a difference in the world. And the thing is that I go out with my friends, and I have a great time, and that's a lot of fun for me, and I don't feel like it necessarily has to be one or the other. I just feel like there's a lot of waste, and you're 16, so you may not be there yet.
No.
Where you're not seeing, well, I mean, you're probably seeing it in high school a little bit, but what you'll see is, like, a vortex where people go on, like, then the behavior that they're having in high school and do it in college and then on daddy's credit card up until, I'm talking 25, 26 years old, and it's a very common phenomena right now where people just are not showing up for their neighbors the way that they need to be. And so I would say that my biggest hope is that, you know, I would stand as an example for someone who shows up for their neighbors, even if their own house is on fire. Because sometimes my house is on fire, I'm not going to lie, but I will show up for my neighbors anyways, you know?
Yeah.
And so, that's definitely something that, I mean, even with my sister, obviously, I hope that she is a contributing member to society as well. And so I just, I don't know, we need more people like that.
Yeah. So I don't have any other questions that I've prepared, and I don't have enough time left in the recording to go into any other ones that I could come up with, because I feel like we'd end up talking for a lot longer than we have left.
Right. But I feel like that's the basis of things. You know, I don't know if you want me to hyper-focus on one thing or the other, but I feel like, you know, that's the story. That's how we have arrived where we've arrived, and I look forward to seeing where it goes next.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you. Thank you so
You're
much
so
for
welcome.
Doing this for me.
If you stop the recording, then I will chat with you for a minute.
Yeah, so let me stop the recording. Thank you. Again, my name is Kira Kasner. Today I interviewed Ellie Coburn. Okay.